When Sir Walter Scott was on his deathbed, he said, "Read me from the book." And thinking of all the famous novels and poems that he had written, someone said, "What book?" He said, "There's only one book, the Bible." 150 years ago, there were those who believed that the Bible was God's word and tried to follow its teaching. There were those who ignored its teaching, but there was hardly anybody who denied that it was one of the greatest books in the world, if not the greatest book. Most of those who refused to receive Christ as Savior at that time would say someday they hope to do so. Most would agree that the Bible was true. During the last 150 years, there has come a tremendous change in the intellectual climate of the Western world, particularly in relation to the Bible. And there is a very widespread attitude now that the Bible is composed largely of myths and legends. Now, this change has come about as a result of a number of circumstances, but there is none of them that has been more effective in causing this, has had a greater influence in this regard than what is known as the higher criticism. It is not easy to talk about a subject like this to a general audience because of the fact that the general Christian audience, in fact, the general secular audience, knows nothing about the higher criticism. The general secular audience thinks the Bible is simply myths and legends, but does not know where that conclusion comes from. And the general Christian audience is apt to think, well, these are some queer theories, very involved theories. What do I need to worry about them? What do I need to think about them for? But in almost every theological seminary that is over 50 years old, the so-called higher criticism is taught as established fact today. And it is this which, as much as any other factor, more than most other factors, has torn down the general attitude of faith toward the Scriptures. In Pennsylvania, a few years ago, the Department of Education prepared a book on religions of the Western world to be used as a high school textbook. I went through the book. It was in mimeograph form at first, and an effort was made to keep the general public from seeing it. But someone lent me a copy. I went through it, picked out a number of errors, wrote the department, and they made a number of changes in it. But even after the changes were made, it remained as it had been before. A book which taught the essentials of this JEDP theory as established fact. And this was to be taught as an elective, but taught to high school students. In most of our large denominations, when the Sunday school lessons deal with the first five books of the Bible, the main ideas of this JEDP theory are presented as established fact. So whatever one's situation is, it is something about which one ought to know something. Now, it is a very large subject. It is really difficult for me to know just which parts to deal with and what parts I must skip over. But I think I will mention a few elements in the development of this theory. In mentioning these, I think about all I can hope to do is to show you that it is not a simple thing, not a simple discovery which someone made, but it came from a series of ideas and changes of attitudes. Now, I've put certain names up here on the board. There's the name of Jean Astruc, 1753. He was a French physician who wrote a book which was entitled something like this, "A Suggestion as to Sources that Might Have Been Used by Moses in Writing the Book of Genesis." Now, Astruc noticed something that had been noticed by many people, the fact that in the book of Genesis, it begins talking about God. God did this, God did that, and so on. For the first chapter and the first four verses in the next chapter. Then it talks about the Lord. That is, our King James Version has the word the Lord, which represents the name of God. The pronunciation of that name is not known. It has sometimes been represented as Jehovah. It is commonly taken under the form of Yahweh nowadays. You have sections in which the name the Lord is used, which is the proper name, and then you have sections in which God is used. So Astruc suggested that there was an A source which used one of these names, and a B source which used the other, and then he picked out about 10 parts that he said didn't belong in any one of these, that were extra things that were inserted in it by Moses when he wrote the Pentateuch. Astruc's theory didn't get much attention. But later on, when attention was given to this, people looked back to Astruc as the one who started the process. Now, the next name I have up there is not really related to biblical studies, but he's very important in this connection. The name of Professor Wolff of Germany, who at about 1800 presented the theory that Homer's Odyssey and Iliad were the works of several different people which had come together by a long process. And Wolff was a very stirring speaker, and people loved to hear him. And the famous German writer Goethe desired to hear Wolff, but he didn't want Wolff to feel nervous because of having such a famous man as Goethe was already by that time in his audience. So he got someone to hide him in a closet right next to the classroom so he could listen to Wolff without Wolff knowing he was there. And he was very thrilled with the cleverness of the way in which Wolff showed how someone had written this and someone else this and someone else this, and they had all been combined together more or less by accident and produced the Iliad and the Odyssey. But later on, Goethe came out very strongly against the whole idea. Goethe said, no one but a great genius could ever have produced the Iliad or the Odyssey. He said there must have been a real genius involved, even though there might be some sections which had been added later, some small changes, but there must be a central mind involved in it. However, Wolff's movement, the movement that was called the Higher Criticism, which began with Homer and with other secular writings, came soon to be applied to parts of the Bible. And I have there the name of Eichhorn. Professor Eichhorn, in 1780, published an Introduction to the Old Testament. And in this book, Professor Eichhorn presented the same theory as Astruc, substantially the same theory, but he said that he had worked out the theory himself, and he never claimed that he had gotten it from Astruc, although later on he found it was very similar to Astruc's theory. But he called the two parts, the E parts from the Hebrew word Elohim, for God, and the J part, the part that used the name the Lord. And Eichhorn, in his first edition, said the book of Genesis, which Moses wrote, was formed from documents previously existing, two long documents, the E document and the J document. Well, so far, there's nothing that we would have to have any big argument or discussion about. It is possible that God revealed to Moses everything that it says about creation and what he says about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's entirely possible. But it is equally possible that Moses had documents, that Abraham had written down the story of his life, that the other patriarchs had, and that Moses had these documents. And he took the material in them, and under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he selected portions and he fit them together, and he wrote the book of Genesis. There would be nothing at all harmful to Christian faith in that idea in Eichhorn's first edition. But in Eichhorn's succeeding editions, he carried it on through the rest of the first five books of the Bible. And when he did that, that made it quite different. Because the first book of the Bible, Genesis, is dealing with events long before Moses' time. But when you get to Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, they are talking about Moses, telling what Moses did and telling what Moses said. And if they are combined from different sources, then Moses could not have written them. They would have to have been written at a much later time. And so the theory now begins to make a change in people's attitude toward these first books. Now, Eichhorn presented a very simple theory, as you see. You read the first chapter of Genesis, it says there was one day and something happened, and then it was evening and morning, the first one day. Then it says God said certain things happened, it was evening and morning the second day. And God did said certain commands, certain things happened, it was evening and morning a third day. It's sort of like a tabulation, you might say. The first chapter and the first part of the second. And in that, the word God is used. But when you go on from there, you have narrative, account of events, until you go on quite a distance, and then you have some genealogy. So-and-so lived so long, and he begat so-and-so, and then he lived so many years and begat sons and daughters. And then he died. And then his son lived so long and had children, and then so long, and he died. And there are these tabulations. And so Eichhorn said the sections that have the name God in, they are the narrative sections, and the sections that have the name, they are the tabulation sections with God in, and the sections that say the Lord, they are the narrative sections. And so he said, in the book of Genesis and the first 20 chapters of Exodus, you can divide it according to the name of God, but after that, the name Jehovah is used constantly. But after that, he said, you can still divide it according to the type of material. And so he took all the tabulations and lists of census and everything like that. He said, that's from the E source. And then the J source, he said, was the narrative sections. And so this is the way that Eichhorn built his theory. You have two documents, E and J, which have been combined together to form the Pentateuch, with only very little else added. You see what a simple, clear theory it seems to be at this point. But then De Wette, in 1805, published a book about the book of Deuteronomy. And De Wette said, you read in 2 Kings how Josiah brought about a great reformation in the land, and he came to do it because he was told that the book of the law had been found in the temple. And then it describes his reformation. Now he said the things that were done by by Josiah, many of them, in fact most of them, are specifically mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy. So he said the book of the law that was found was not the whole Pentateuch, it was just the book of Deuteronomy. And then he said, the book of Deuteronomy was written by somebody and hidden there so that it could be found and they could think it was an ancient book. And the author pretended it was by Moses because he wanted to get certain changes made. And so he said it was a pious fraud. Somebody at that time wrote it and claimed it was by Moses. And so here we have another document, the D document, which he said was a fraud, but certainly not written by Moses, if it's written nearly 1,000 years after the time of Moses. Well, this theory then was circulated among a number of scholars and taught in certain schools in Germany and in France, but it did not have any great impact for quite a long time. In 1853, just 100 years after Astruc wrote, a man named Hupfeldt wrote a book which said this document that has the name Elohim in it, has many sections in the book of Genesis that are almost identical in style with the J document. So he divides the E document into two different ones, E1, E2. And then there's Deuteronomy he recognized as another document. And he ran these two, and also J, of course, through the first four books. But in after Hupfeld, about 10, 15 years later, I didn't put the date down, a man named Groff took it up with a new approach. Now, I've put after E1, I should have a period or a dash something there, an NAR for narrative. Groff said that this E document, which Hupfeld called E1, he said this document is partly composed of this narrative, but partly composed of laws. And he said these laws are very complicated. They're very extensive laws. And so, he said, they must be written at the end instead of at the beginning. And so he divided the E document, the E1 document, into two parts. And so he said this was the order of them. E1, the narrative parts, E2, J, D, E, and then the part of E1 with laws in. Well, Groff was followed by a very brilliant German professor, Julius Wellhausen. And the theory is sometimes called the Wellhausen theory, sometimes called the Groff-Wellhausen theory, because Wellhausen pointed out that this E1 narrative and E1 laws were so similar, he said they must belong together. And so he took the whole of this former E document and put it at the end. What was thought to be the very beginning was moved to the very end. Now, of course, the book of Genesis has a structure. These are the generations of heaven and earth. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Abraham, and so on. And all those sections were considered part of this E1 document, and it was considered as the general structure of Genesis, and then the other parts were inserted. This makes that come at the very end, and the other parts all centuries earlier. And so Wellhausen in 1878 wrote his book, in which he did something that none of these writers had done before. He wrote in a style that was easy to read. Most of the German books are very difficult to read. Sometimes you read a whole page before you come to the verb. But Wellhausen had a very beautiful German style. He could express complicated thoughts very simply, and his book on the introduction to the history of Israel just swept Germany and France and Britain. And it had a tremendous influence with all the younger scholars. The older scholars that held this higher criticism held the views of the earlier ones, but all the younger scholars adopted the Wellhausen theory. And it was in 1878 that it began to be a real force. But you see the complication of the development of it. And now you have it as Wellhausen held to it. He switched the order of E and J also, so that he had first the J document, then the E document, and then the Deuteronomy at the time of Josiah, and then the P document, that's the E1, he changed the name to P because he said this is a priestly document which has all these complicated rules for sacrifice and everything, and this is at the very end of a long development. And you have your idea of God gradually developing. You have a long development of the evolution of thought going through all these. And S.R. Driver in Great Britain in 1891 presented this theory in an introduction to the literature of the Old Testament, which went through a large number of editions and which was even reprinted in 1956. And S.R. Driver applies it not only to the books from Genesis to Deuteronomy, but he divides up most of the other books of the Old Testament among various sources. And it was carried on to the New Testament. And the New Testament books were supposed to be divided up similarly into various sources. And today, in most of the older seminaries, they will teach that the Gospel of Mark and a source called Q were the early writings, and then that in Matthew and in Luke we have various combinations of them with this same sort of a theory of various sources coming together and being joined, and thus, more or less by accident, these pieces of literature coming into existence. Now, 60 years ago, perhaps much more recently, if you picked up a book dealing with this, they would say, this is the higher criticism. Now, they'd say, higher criticism is a term that is regularly known in literature because it is a regular branch of criticism. Lower criticism studies the wording of a book, studies its nature, its details, tries to get the correct text and so on. But higher criticism studies its sources and its authorship, and higher criticism is a common thing used in all types of literature. Well, that was true 60 years ago, but it is not true today. I was greatly interested 10 years ago to go through a large number of recent books on literary criticism, on general literary criticism. And in every case, I looked up higher criticism in the index, and I never found in one of them any reference to higher criticism unless it might be a reference to the Bible. The term has just been dropped out of ordinary literary study. This development here, which divides the Bible up into all these little sources and from different backgrounds and all uniting together in this way, which is taught as established fact in so many areas today, and which has had such a great influence on people's faith in the Bible, often without their realizing it because it has been mediated through others. This attitude, 60 years ago, was common toward all ancient writings, or even comparatively recent writings. Books about Shakespeare would discuss. Here are the parts that Shakespeare wrote. Now, this was probably written by Bacon. This probably was written by someone else, and they would go through and tell who had written this line and who had written that line, and would divide up Shakespeare that way. They would divide up most of our early literature, and higher criticism was very, very common, even as late as 1940, I believe. But today, it is practically dead, except as relates to the Bible. I read a book on general literature not long ago by a professor in Bennington College, in which I found that the term higher criticism occurred in the index. And in the course of the book, there was one place where he said, we are surprised at the almost miraculous way in which Bible students have been able to divide the Bible up into its sources according to the higher criticism of the Bible. But as far as other books were concerned, he recognized that it is a phase of thought that is almost as extinct today as the idea of drawing blood out of our veins when we are ill. It has just disappeared, but here it is quite firmly established. I read a book recently by a professor in Union Seminary, New York, in which he said, there are many reasons why we may have to give up the Wellhausen theory. There are many difficulties with it, but we must always remember that we are grateful to the Wellhausen theory for having destroyed the idea of verbal inspiration of the Bible. And therefore, he said, we should go very slow about giving it up and be sure what we are going to substitute in its place. Now, I'd like to read to you a few statements that I have culled out of various writings about general literature, just to show what the developments have been. Here is a book published in 1962 on in a collection of critical essays edited by George Steiner and Robert Fagles, in which he says, in the late 19th century, dismemberment was all the rage. In a single chapter of Luke, textual analysis revealed five distinct levels of authorship and interpolation. The plays attributed to that illiterate actor Shakespeare appeared to have been compiled by a committee which included Bacon, the Earl of Oxford, Marlowe, recusant Catholics, and printers, devils of extraordinary ingenuity. This fine fury of decomposition lasted well into the 1930s. As late as 1934, Gilbert Murray could discover no reputable scholar ready to defend the view that a single poet had written either or both the Iliad and the Odyssey. Today, the wheel has come full turn. In Homeric, biblical, and Shakespearean scholarship, the idea of unity has carried the day. To Professor Whitman of Harvard, the central personal vision and ineradicable unity of the Iliad are beyond doubt. Robert Gordas, in the book of God and Man, published by the University of Chicago Press, says, "Before embarking on a detailed investigation of the evidence, we may note the growing disfavor in which the atomization of ancient literary documents is viewed by contemporary scholarship. Increasingly, the study of ancient literatures like that of the Homeric epics has been focusing attention on the unity and meaning of the whole work, rather than upon the disparity of the constituent elements. That the indiscriminate and even accidental lumping together of scattered literary fragments by an obtuse redactor who often did not understand the material he was working with could produce a masterpiece, that naive faith of 19th century literary critics is no longer widely shared today." Albert Gerard, in his preface to World Literature, he's professor of general and comparative literature at Stanford University, writes, "It is not denied that literature uses the same stuff as folklore, but it is claimed that folklore is turned into literature only through an individual act of conscious organization. A book is a piece of work, not an accident." He said, "To dissolve Homer into a myth or a committee, much stronger acid would be needed than the Wolfian school has been able to produce." R.W. Chambers of the University of London said, "Fortunately, 20 years ago, that great teacher of English, Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, gave his answer to the problem. 'Gentlemen, I could persuade you to remember that you are English and go always for the thing, casting out of your vocabulary all such words as tendencies, influences, revivals, revolts. Tendencies did not write the Canterbury Tales. Geoffrey Chaucer wrote them. Influences did not make the Fairy Queen. Edmund Spenser made it. I hope to satisfy the reader that tendencies did not write Piers Plowman, that a man called William Langland wrote it." Previous to that time, Piers Plowman was almost universally agreed, was made up of at least two different documents combined together. And R.W. Chambers, speaking about the Beowulf, that early English epic, which was divided up into sources by so many writers, he said, "Half a dozen motorbikes cannot be combined to make a Rolls-Royce car." I have a number of other quotations that I think I'd better not take time to read from other recent writers, authorities on literary criticism, showing the almost complete change that has taken place in this regard in all areas except study of the Bible. But these people who are students of literature, most of them know nothing about the Bible, and when they come to refer to the Bible, they simply go to a scholar in that field who gives them the Wellhausen theory. And if they refer to the Bible, they refer to the Wellhausen theory as established fact. I was interested in reading a book about trying to show that someone, we call him Homer, we don't know anything about Homer except through very early tradition, but that some great mind composed most of the Iliad and of the Odyssey, and in order to show that such a thing could happen as early as that, he said, after all, at the time when Homer wrote it, the J document of the Pentateuch had already appeared in Israel. If he is denying the theory as regards Homer, but he is simply taking the word of someone he considers an expert in this area, for there being a J document. Now, I wrote the name ASEAN up here. And I don't think there are many people today, unless they are specialists, who have ever heard of ASEAN. But ASEAN was the name of an alleged bard in ancient Scotland. And a man named James McPherson, in 1761, with a second edition in 1763, wrote a book which he said was the poems of ASEAN, the chieftain who had lived up in northern Scotland many centuries before. And these wonderful poems of ASEAN, showing the wonderfully high state of culture of that very early day, were read all over Great Britain and all over Europe, and Goethe thought they were just very wonderful, and they were highly praised by great literary men because of the wonderful literary value of the writings of this great ancient bard, ASEAN. All except Samuel Johnson accepted them. But Samuel Johnson said, "I believe that these are the work of James McPherson, not of ASEAN at all." Samuel Johnson said, "This is a fraud." And the strange thing is that even though the literary value of them was regarded so very highly that men like Goethe and others praised them very, very greatly, once it was proved that McPherson had only a few small snatches of poetry from an early time, and he built up all the rest himself, people were so disgusted with them that they turned away from them. And today, the name of ASEAN is hardly remembered except by students of literature. Now, if the Bible, like ASEAN, were a fraud, if it were formed by such an accidental combination as this, we would expect that it also would disappear. And as a matter of fact, we see the great change in attitude toward the Bible, which is due to a very great extent to the wide acceptance of this Wellhausen theory. It is therefore very important for those who believe in the Bible to see exactly what the situation is and to realize that this theory is a tissue of imagination. In the case of ASEAN, it was possible to take the manuscripts, compare them with McPherson's writing, and to look for evidences that he actually had any early material, and to satisfy all people at the time that it was a fraud. Being such wonderful literature as they seem to think it was, it seems strange to me it's so completely forgotten. But if people don't want fraud, and if the Bible is a fraud, we might as well forget it. But the fact is that the Bible is not a fraud. The fact is that God revealed his truths to Moses, and Moses wrote them down under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, who kept him from error as he wrote, so that no false ideas would be introduced into what he wrote. And the same is true of the other books of the Bible. But this abandoned theory, as far as literary criticism is concerned, is still very, very much alive as far as biblical studies are concerned, and is being widely taught as established fact today. Now, I'd like to call your attention to what I've written over here. This Eichhorn presented four arguments for his very simple two-document theory that he presented. Now, nobody holds that two-document theory today. As you've seen there, it was divided up into three documents, then into four documents, and then they were reshifted, as I've shown along in these different lines. And after S.R. Driver wrote, it became customary to take each of these documents and divide them up, so that some books will tell you what's in J1, what's in J2, J3, J4, what's in P1, P2, P3, and P4, and so on. That was carried to such an absurd length that there's been a reaction against it. But within the last 40 years, one writer has suggested that a large part of the J document should be called an L document. Another has suggested a certain part be called an S document. Another suggests a certain part be called an N document, and a different one makes a K document. None of them have been widely accepted. This division into such many divisions is quite widely recognized now to be utterly absurd, but the idea of the four main documents is very strongly held. About 10 years ago, when I was in Seattle, I was engaged in a discussion, and I went into the public library and got every book that I could find in that large library of particularly books of a popular type that dealt with the first books of the Bible. And I found that books by Jews, books by Roman Catholics, books by Protestants, and everyone I found in that library simply presented the Wellhausen theory as established fact. All books written within the last 30 years. Well, now the four arguments that he gave were first the argument from divine names. Now, if you could simply divide and put everything that uses this name here and this name here, it's a very simple argument. But as you noticed there, it was noticed that the material they called the E document, most of it in Genesis, is more like the so-called J document than it is like the other parts they put in the E document. That is to say, the E document was largely made up of statistical statements, tables, lists of detailed laws, and so on. The J document was largely narrative. But many sections of narrative also use the name of God. And when you examine it, you find that the reason for these names is very simple and was recognized by the early Christian church. He is called God as the great powerful one. He is called Jehovah, or the Lord, as the redeeming one, caring for his people. And sometimes the emphasis is on one, sometimes the emphasis is on the other. There are many cases where you may use either name. There are many cases where one or the other is most appropriate. And we all find that in our relations with people. We will call people by one name under certain circumstances, but another name or title under other circumstances, and once we're using one, we're apt to continue it until there's a special reason for switching to the other designation. So this argument from the divine names actually is easily explained why there should be the two names, and after the 20th chapter of Exodus, only the one name is used anyway, all through the rest of the Pentateuch. And the argument is completely broken up by the development of the theories, you see. Now, the second argument is that there is a continuous narrative. In other words, Eichhorn said, you take all the sections that use the name God, Elohim, and you take all the sections that use the name Lord or Jehovah, and you put the two together and you've got a complete narrative. You can go right straight through. And one of the prime illustrations of that is used to this day in Sunday schools and in most seminaries of any great age is the story of the flood. And you read that the waters came down and the waters descended. Well, now you only need one of those two words. And so you can take one of them, put it in one document, the other, and put it in the other document. And you have in the first part of the story of the flood, where it's describing the tremendous nature of the flood, it's very easy to get two continuous stories out of it. Only you could get three or four, because all the elements in the telling of the coming of this tremendous flood are multiplied, and words are piled up in order to show how tremendous it was. So it's very easy to take some and take the others and get two complete stories. But when you come to the end of it, the flood simply stops, and there you only have one. And so the latter part of the flood story, the continuous narrative idea, simply breaks down. But according to Eichhorn's idea, you could have these two continuous stories running right through. But you notice as the theory is actually held, it's no longer two. And the result is, in order to get a continuous story, the so-called P document will have one verse here, and then two chapters later it'll have a half a verse, and two chapters later it will have two verses, and so on. And it appears very arbitrary the way they are selected in order to make a continuous document. I went through once about six scholarly presentations of this theory in relation to the Old Testament, books which are used in books on the Old Testament, which are used, one of them claims to be used in more than 200 colleges and universities today as a textbook in the United States. And in these books, they often give you a list of what verses are in the J document, what are in the P, what are in the E, and what are in the D document. And I made a list showing what verses each one put in which document. And in at least a third of the verses, they would differ as to which document they put it in, though they were very dogmatic in their insistence that this was the way the documents ran. Now, this continuous narrative, then, simply does not work out. You have to select a few words here and a line or two here, and the division of it, as the theory developed, completely wrecks that argument, which Eichhorn presented so strong. Now, the third argument for it is parallel passages. That's closely related, as you see, to the idea of the continuous narrative. It is that you have a thing told twice. Like it says that Abraham told a half lie when he said that Sarah, who was his half-sister, was his sister, instead of saying that she was his wife. And the result was that Pharaoh took her into his palace. And then God rebuked Pharaoh for it, and he gave her back to Abraham and rebuked Abraham. Then we read that Abraham went to the land of the Philistines, and he did the same thing. He told Abimelech, "This is my sister," which she was, the half-sister, but Abimelech put her into his palace, and the Lord closed all the wombs of all of Abimelech's people as punishment, and Abimelech saw what the situation was, and he rebuked Abraham for it. Well, they say these are parallel passages. There's only one thing that happened, but the accounts differ just slightly, so you must have two different documents. This story's been remembered a different way. But then we find a third parallel there, because Isaac did the same thing with his wife, and she wasn't his sister like Sarah was Abraham's. And so you have the third parallel, but they don't put it in the third document. They agree in putting it in one of the same documents that has the other. The most cases, for one thing, the number of these parallels is grossly exaggerated in the accounts of it. And for another thing, parallels often clearly represent different things, different incidents altogether. And, I've spent a whole semester going through and looking at them and pointing out how this argument just doesn't work out. The fourth argument is the argument from style. And the real fact there is that the difference in style is a difference of subject matter. If you are describing an event, you use a different style than you use if you are giving a statistical table. Anybody will. It wasn't so long ago that there was a Ray Stannard Baker wrote a book on the events of the administration of Woodrow Wilson, a book which was widely taken as a very fine presentation of political and economic events at that time. And Ray Stannard Baker also wrote a series of books that were called The Friendly Road, accounts of his adventures as he walked through the country and met different people. And he wrote them under the pen name of David Grayson. And people couldn't believe the same man wrote them, because they were so utterly different in style. Different material calls for a different style. And so the difference between the P document and the rest is that the P document is largely like Genesis 1, one day, second day, third day, it's lists, it's tabulations. and the other documents are narrative. And that is not accepted as a valid argument for different sources in anything except in biblical study. And in biblical study, it has been carried to such wild extremes that, as I read you here in one chapter of Luke, today it will be said there are five different sources in the one chapter. It's been carried all through the Bible. It is abandoned as far as other writings are concerned. The world of theology, of religion, needs to catch up with the world of literary criticism and recognize that this is an abandoned theory which is being tenaciously held simply as a means of reducing to myths and legends the book that God has given us as a revelation of His truth. Now, there's much more that could be said about it. If we had time, it's very hard to know where to stop. But possibly some of you will have to leave now, and possibly there are some of you who would have some certain phase of this general subject or something related to it you'd like to ask a question about.